thing I wanted to show this morning but forgot, and that is the official introduction of the workshop. And it's an image of Richardson. If you're doing numerical physics, you probably heard of Richardson in at least 3 or 4 different contexts. There's the Richardson extrapolation that was mentioned earlier. There's something in turbulence and so on. And he was actually one of the first people to use computers, so large-scale computing in science. That was in 1922. Of course, there were no electronic computers available, and these computers were not even mechanical. These computers were people. There was a people performing a calculation. He predicted the weather. Unfortunately, he used an unstable algorithm. He didn't smooth it enough. So he predicted a gigantic change in the weather that did not actually happen. But apart from that, it was the first attempt to use high-performance computing, because they want parallel computing in science, and still important. Well, I'm going to talk about stability later on. So that was this. But now let me talk about computational relativistic astrophysics and a bit of background for that. Just one page about physics. Many phenomena in astrophysics are ultimately driven by gravity. You can extract a lot of energy out of gravity. For example, if something falls into a black hole, you can get up to approximately 1/3 of the rest mass energy out in energy if it's not swallowed by a black hole. And many explosive astrophysical phenomena are ultimately powered by relativity. So if you want to think about the central energy where actually the shakers and movers are in astrophysics, then relativity is important. I say that because I'm interested in relativity. I'm sure there are many other interesting things as well. And of course, there's the other thing, that there are gravitational wave observatories that are going to soon, well, for many years, they are going to soon detect gravitational waves. And that means one wants to predict the exact gravitational waveforms that are produced to design the experiments and later also to analyze the measurement results of these experiments. For example, LIGO or GEO-600, me coming from Germany, I like to emphasize GEO-600. And if you want to study systems where relativity is important, these are probably going to be black holes, neutron stars, or binaries of these as astrophysical sources, excluding cosmology here. And what I'm interested in this talk are time evolution problems, so systems of coupled partial differential equations. There are several classes, and for example, elliptic partial differential equations are about equilibrium problems or optimization problems or steady state problems. And I'm going to ignore that because that involves a very different kind of mathematics and numerical methods. Instead, I'm looking for time evolution problems or initial value problems. So you have an initial situation and then want to predict what happens in the end. And as is usual in numerics, I'm going to start from equations of motions that are given. I'm going to ignore Lagrangian or Hamiltonians as they exist. One could probably make quite a bit of use of the Lagrangian or particular formulation, but the field of numerics probably comes much more from an engineering point of view than from a strictly mathematical point of view. And often Lagrangians or Hamiltonians don't play an important role when you want to solve something on a supercomputer, at least in this context. And partial differential equations, time evolution problems, they can have gauge freedoms, and they can have constraints. The Einstein equations have both. And they are constraints that you need to enforce because they're part of the system. I'm going to only consider constraints that are kind of on the side. You assume the constraints are satisfied initially, and later on you just monitor the constraints. For example, the V constraint in Maxwell's equations, if it's satisfied initially, then the Maxwell equations guarantee that it's going to be enforced. The divergence of the magnetic field, which needs to be zero, the electric field, similar. And something that is often overlooked is regarding gauge conditions. If you have a system of partial differential equations and of gauge freedoms, that one actually needs to choose gauge conditions before the system can be solved. So if you want to study the Einstein equations and want to study whether something is stable or well posed, then you can't do that without choosing gauge conditions. So one can say that the Einstein equations admit gauge conditions that lead to well posed formulations, but you can't say the Einstein equations themselves are well posed. That statement doesn't quite make sense because the system is incomplete. Some degrees of freedoms are not satisfied. And since one may want to change the gauge conditions under various contexts, there's sometimes a bit of a confusion of whether something is well posed or not. I'm also going to speak about discretization here. There's an example that we actually already saw before. That's the Hill-Briggs discretization. If you Google for discretization, it's one of the first images that comes up from the NASA website. That's the discretization of a sphere. Of course, you have a continuous field living on a sphere, and discretization just means that you represent the function living on the sphere in some other manifold with a finite number of degrees of freedom. And there are a few basic ways to discretize something. There's finite differences. They could just sample something at certain grid points and then calculate derivatives by something like a Taylor expansion. There are finite volumes where you put cells on the manifold and then average over the cells of finite elements. You choose a set of basis functions. It's also very similar to spectral methods. And the derivative operators then become essentially a set of matrices that you can handle numerically or a set of sparse matrices, depending on the size of the system. If you solve the Einstein equations, you often have a billion degrees of freedoms or so. And then, of course, you want to have sparse matrices to calculate derivatives. If you have a more efficient representation in spectral methods, then you have many fewer degrees of freedom and kind of dense matrices. If you want to go from the Einstein equations, you want to solve them numerically, then, as I mentioned before, you have to massage the equations a bit. You have to choose a particular formulation, choose a particular set of gauge conditions. There are two well-known formulations that do that. One of them is called the BSSN formulation. The original equation up there, GAB equals HBAB, that is not really suitable to solve the system numerically. So solving the Einstein equations typically means that you want to know the metric everywhere in the spacetime. And once you have the metric, you can do everything else. You can integrate, can calculate distances, can calculate the curvature by taking derivatives of the metric, and so on. So if you want to do the Einstein equation, it's a time evolution problem. First, you perform what is called a 3 plus 1 decomposition. You formally break the four vectors into three vectors and scalars. You can normalize the partial differential equations. That means you replace all higher derivatives with first derivatives by introducing new variables. That is not really necessary, but it leads to a standard form in many mathematical tools to analyze stability and many numerical tools. For example, integrating ODEs exist only for the standard form for the first order form. You can develop your own tools or develop your own mathematical mechanisms, but sometimes it's easier to use a first order form. Of course, you have many more equations, Einstein equations. You have 10 equations. If you write them down in a first order form, you end up with 50 equations. So you choose what you want to implement in a computer program. You have to choose gauge conditions, as I mentioned, and then you may fiddle with equations, may modify the equations that you want. You add constraints, choose linear combinations, and so on. And that can be very important to come to a well-posed initial value problem and to a stable formulation. Here's a tool that I mentioned, in the first talk, Lukasz already mentioned that he uses automated code generation to deal with the complexity. We do the same here. The BSSN formulation happens to have 25 equations, and the right-hand side of the BSSN equation contains about 5,000 different terms. And of course, you don't want to implement that by hand in a Fortran code or something, in particular not if you want to experiment with gauge conditions, modifying them, because then you have to re-implement everything over and over again. So I think most groups use something like automated code generation, mostly based on Mathematica or Maple, that can spit out C or Fortran code from something that you write in Mathematica or Maple notation. And another advantage of that is then you can apply optimizations or transform the code. Actually, C or Fortran is a rather low-level language. It's really far away from the mathematics that you would use on the blackboard. And you have to write a lot of C code corresponding to a very short bit of blackboard code. And you can automatically apply many optimizations as you generate code, speed up the code that otherwise you'd have to implement manually. And if you do that too early, then of course the code becomes too complicated. That was the Donald Knuth statement from earlier. I'd like to show off a bit the discretizations that we use. One particular possibility is to use, for example, a multi-patch system. It is in Fortran or in these languages easiest to have handled domains if you use finite differences that consist of a topologically at least rectangular region. And you can combine several of these rectangular regions and distort them and can, for example, use four of them to give you a circle, or you can use six of them depicted here to then discretize a region of spacetime that has a spherical outer boundary and has a spherical hole in the middle, and that is particularly suited to evolve a black hole where there's a singularity in the center, binary black hole systems, and so on. Or if you don't have a black hole in the center, then you can use seven patches like that, fill up the hole with a square, and automatically it also adapts your resolution. Far out, you have a lower resolution. In the center, you have a higher resolution. Another way to put the resolution where you want it to handle the large differences in length and timescales, is adaptive mesh refinement. In adaptive mesh refinement, you have a cross grid and certain region of the domain you can put a finer grid, the green grid, or even a finer grid, the blue grid here, and thus put your grid points where it counts. And in the finer grid, you would also choose a finer time step size, because you also need a higher resolution in time. And finally, you want to do parallel processing, and one particular approach to do that is called ghost zones. So you have your simulation domain. Here, for example, a grid of 8 by 4 grid points, and you can split it up into 4 processes. Then each of the processes gets 2 by 4 grid points. But if you want to evaluate the finer difference derivative operator, you need values of neighboring grid points, and asking a neighboring process is an expensive operation, so you don't want to do that. So instead, you keep a local cache, and you do that by ghost zones. You extend the arrays that you have on one process by one grid point in every direction. And then if you need to calculate a derivative, you can look up the value here. Of course, this value here is actually calculated by that process corresponding to this point. Whenever you change something, you have to send the update to the other processes. And that requires a bit of software engineering, actually becomes quite tedious and complex, but is necessary to get good performance on HPC systems. So much for the methods and tools that we use for the Einstein equations. I'd also like to talk a bit about well-posedness and stability. And it is rather unfortunate that when you're given a system of PDEs, it's very difficult to determine whether it's actually well-posed or not. And there's a bit, depending on your background, you may have different opinions whether you should study a system mathematically before you implement it numerically. Some people are good in math and would like to spend a lot of time determining the mathematical properties of a system before you implement it numerically. Other people find that more complicated, would rather implement it numerically or numerically test stability before you go on to study the mathematical properties.
What are the more numerical?
What usually happens is that a little bit of an uncertainty or noise initially, and that is amplified exponentially or even more, and then you can't make any reasonable prediction. Usually you notice that, you notice an instability popping up, because the worst case is that you have an instability and you don't notice that you have one, and then you write a paper about it and just make a fool of yourself. But there are numerical tests you can do that exclude many cases. For example, you can artificially add noise to the initial conditions and see how the noise is amplified. Of course, the most important thing is that you study the problem at different resolutions and see whether you can get similar results. That's not.
Why should just look at the principal part of the system, calculate the eigenvectors, and if there is a complete set, then you have a fighting chance. If not, you shouldn't even start that part.
And well,
so this is part of the learning curve that we went through between that very big, that picture with lots of people that David showed, and 5 years later, now we know, and we discovered. In fact, the main formulation was used at that time. We know that's pretty bad.
So it's actually, you can't just calculate the eigenvectors, because of course these would be a matrix 25 by 25 elements, and each element is not a number. Each element is a particular equation, particular formula. And that is difficult to calculate eigenvalues, proof under what conditions they are. Set or eigenvalues.
No, I disagree. We can. In fact, we have even for the 40 by 40 system, you just estimate through the energy method and it's done.
The energy method, yes, that works. I was actually going to show an example on that. But I'm looking for eigenvalues and so on for a general equation, that is actually quite complicated.
But it's the same. One problem gets mapped into the other. I think at the mathematical level, it's very easy. It requires some, maybe 2-3 days of work, but there's nothing very difficult.
So there's, as Luis just mentioned, there's also a bit of a disconnect or a language barrier between the people with more mathematical experience and people with more of an engineering background. And I remember one discussion at the conference in Mexico where the definition of stability was given. So mathematical definition of stability means you have the state vector that is evolved in time, and the system is stable if you can bound the norm of that state vector by an exponential that grows in time, something like A exponential alpha t. And from a mathematical point of view, that is very good, because if it's bounded by an exponential, that means the solution exists at all times, and all is fine. And from a physicist's point of view, if something grows exponentially, it doesn't make sense. I mean, that's the definition of an instability. And of course, as a mathematician, you would like to include exponentially growing solutions, because if you have u dot equals u as an equation, a very simple equation, you want to be able to include that into the system that you can analyze. And the key point that was kind of being drawn in that discussion is that this coefficient alpha here, the growth rate, needs to be independent of the resolution. If the growth rate depends on the resolution, that means the system can explode faster as you increase the resolution. And that is then an instability, because you want to have a very high resolution to reach the continuum. But if the system then explodes instantaneously, then it's really stable. And actually, something like this could make sense to have something growing exponentially. If it still converges, you may still want to call that stable. And I'd like to briefly give an example of a system and how that could be stable or unstable. So it's a rather simple equation, a system of PDEs. Actually, it's just ODEs. You have A dot equals 0, B dot equals 0, and you have a constraint, A minus B equals 0. And of course, there's a stable system, and all is fine. And if the constraint is satisfied initially, then under time evolution, the constraint will remain satisfied at all times, and everything is fine. Now, if you modify the system, you can, for example, the constraint is zero, so you can add a multiple of the constraints to the right-hand side of one of these equations. So you could have A dot equals A minus B, B dot equals zero, A minus B equals zero. And in principle, it has the same solutions. If A minus B is zero initially, then it will remain zero, but the system is now unstable. If A is slightly positive in the beginning, then of course A will continue to grow exponentially, and that makes the system unstable. And here it's obvious, but if you have the Einstein equations or something, then it's not obvious, and then you need to make sure that you don't have this kind of system, but have this kind of system. And of course, what you can also do is you can change the sign here, and then you have something that, even if the constraint is not quite satisfied initially, will drive the constraint to zero by decreasing A until it's actually B. And this is the kind of modifications that you may have to make with the system, and that's on the continuum level, even before you.
This formulations that we're using do that here. We break down invariants with respect to violations of constraints, and we do it such that if you go in this direction, if you have an initial violation, kind of like what you were showing, then it goes down. But if you go in the opposite direction, it's going to blow up.
That's exactly what the term does here. If you change the time direction, you change the sign in front of the constraint here, and that's what makes it stable or unstable. Here, that is without any derivatives. Of course, you can involve derivatives, and then the analysis becomes more complicated. But that shows that these problems exist even on the level of ODEs already. And the other point that I wanted to make is that if you have a system that is well-posed in the continuum, of course, that doesn't guarantee that it's also well-posed after you discretize it. There are some discretization methods that work for some systems, but if they work for some system, it doesn't mean that they also work for other systems. There's one term that is called enigmatic discretization. If a certain theorem holds in the continuum, it does not necessarily hold in the discrete. Usually, some theorems can't be proven, and usually you want to have three properties that hold in the continuum, or now only two of them hold in the discrete domain. There's always some kind of vicious circle like that. And mimetic discretization, the concept there means that you choose some properties that are important to you, and you choose a discretization method so that this property continues to hold in the discrete, and you may lose others. For example, in hydrodynamics, it's based on conservation. So you choose a discretization that ensures that you get conservation, not approximate conservation, but exact conservation. Or in electrodynamics, if you evolve the Maxwell equations for any kind of examples as an engineer would, then you make sure that the constraints satisfy, not approximately, but exactly at all times. Now, if you do electrodynamics on a curved background, it may not be possible anymore, so you lose something there. And one question is, if you solve the Einstein equations, what kind of mimetic discretization would you want here? So some people have written down the Einstein equations formally as a set of conservation laws, and you can conserve something, but the conserved quantities are just mathematically abstractly defined. There's no real physical insight in there. But the people have tried to make sure that the constraints are satisfied in the Einstein equations, but that doesn't unfortunately work out, that the constraints in the Einstein equations are different than in the Maxwell equations, that you can't derive a discretization based on that. So there's a bit of an open problem here, but you can do that. Something that I'd like to mention about discrete stability, there's one way in which you can prove stability if you can define an energy and that energy is positive or at least bounded from below. And if you can prove that under time evolution that energy is non-increasing, then you have proven stability. That's not necessary, but the sufficient condition for stability. And you can do that in the continuum. And you can also do that in the discrete. And if you can do that in the discrete, then you have a stable system. And again, a simple example for that could be the scalar wave equation. If you have the scalar wave equation, then of course it is U double dot equals U double prime. When you can define an energy for the scalar wave equation, 1/2 integral over the domain U dot squared plus U prime squared. And I mean, the proof is easy, but I want to go through the proof because the steps of the proof are actually interesting. You take the time derivative of the energy, which is then integral U dot double dot, just integration, what's it called in English? Chain rule, thank you. Plus U prime, U dot prime. So you just take the derivative with this, then you plug in the time evolution equations that you have here, that is U dot U double prime plus U prime, U dot prime. And then you can do integration by parts. You get a boundary term that you ignore because this is on a blackboard, so you want to keep it simple. And then you find out that the remainder is then actually zero. So you prove that energy is conserved. That means the system is stable. That is in the continuum. And you may want to perform the same proof with analogous steps in the discrete as well. And that means you want to have a discretization method where you can apply the same steps of the proof. In particular, you would here need to apply the chain rule, and you would need to apply integration by parts, which in discrete then is called summation by parts. And if you have a discretization method that guarantees this kind of steps, then if you know such an energy in the continuum, you can also define it in discrete, and then you have the stable discretization. And if you have another discretization method, you may run into trouble. And it's actually in particular boundary problems that cause trouble, which of course I left out here for simplicity. Yes, yes. Well, in the end, I'm going to plug in the discrete equations of motions, not the continuum equations of motion. And of course, the discrete solution satisfies the discrete equations of motion, not the continuum ones.
Yeah, it's related to your dark question. So the analysis at the discrete level is done in what is called the semi-discrete. So you assume the time stays continuum, but not the space. And then there are some theorems that say that if your time discretization is at least third order accurate, you're going to preserve the full this what you find in the semi-discrete level into the full discrete level.
Okay. So you can do that because if you only discretize space and keep time continuous, then you're left with ODEs, and there's a large body of knowledge about that. You can also perform this analysis with a discrete time and discrete space. Of course, it just becomes more complicated because in the time evolution, you also have to plug in the discrete operator, which is more complicated. I would like to close with the Einstein Toolkit. The Einstein Toolkit is a software framework and a set of modules that we use to evolve the black holes, the neutron stars that I mentioned earlier. And that is a community effort. Actually based on the Cactus framework that David outlined before. The idea is to have a state-of-the-art tools for numerical relativity, relativistic astrophysics. We have modules for initial conditions, for time evolution, for the Einstein equations, GRMHD, for waveform extractions, and so on. And as a community project, everybody's free to do that. Thank you.